House Judiciary Committee for Friday, February 8th, 2008, and I will open a work session on House Bill 3633 for the purpose of hearing about proposed amendments. And we have, Council, could you want to orient us to where we are on the...
We have the Dash 1 amendments before you, Mr. Chairman, as a committee with the Hamden Gross version before you, which I believe came from the Department of Justice. Attorney General Hardy Myers here and Pete Shepard to walk us through the changes.
Very good. Mr. Myers, Mr. Shepard.
Thank you, Chairman Person, members. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, joined by Deputy Attorney General Pete Shepard. And as just mentioned by Council, you have before you two documents. One is the Legislative Council's Dash 1 amendments, and the second is a copy of the printed bill with those Dash 1 amendments interlineated so that you can see at a glance where the changes that the Dash 1 amendments are making will occur. The work group met again yesterday to consider some additional recommendations that had come from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, agreed on certain additional recommended amendments that are going to be developed as the Dash 2 amendments for the committee. But I'm pleased to tell the committee that all of the amendments that you'll be seeing, both the Dash 1 amendments and the Dash 2 amendments, are consensus recommendations of the working group. That is to say, all members of the work group either support all of the amendments or they are neutral as to the amendments. But there is no member of the work group who opposes any of the amendments you will be seeing. So I'm very pleased that we have that unity of view as to the recommended changes we would be asking the committee to consider. With that, Chair McPherson and members, I'll ask Pete to walk the committee now through the Dash 1 amendments as shown by the interlineated version of the print bill you have before you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General, and so that a subsequent reader of the audio or listener to the audio record can connect up the document that you are looking at and one we'll be discussing. It is the document that on the first page is a photocopy of the first page of House Bill 3633 as printed and introduced with the notation hand engrossed with 3633-1. 2808 by DOJ. And as the Attorney General has mentioned, I did go through the Dash 1 amendments and do my best to faithfully capture all of those in the handwritten amendments that you have before you. I did find in reviewing them this morning one error, which I'll point out to you when we get to that. But to begin then with Section 1, you'll recall this is the one section of the bill that will stay in effect regardless of the fate of the House Joint Resolutions that propose amendments to the Constitution. In sum, the changes worked by the Dash 1 amendments to Section 1 are designed to make sure, first of all, that the scope of the Attorney General's activity stops short of the judicial branch, and that's because, obviously, of the separation of powers that is written into the Constitution. And so some of the language you see that it amends Section 1 by the Dash 1 amendments is intended to ensure that that principle is carried out faithfully in the statute as well as it is in the Constitution. In addition, these amendments include amendments requested by the Juvenile Directors Association, and we were asked to make sure that in defining the scope of the Attorney General's model rulemaking process that's described in Section 1, that it did include the juvenile departments, and that juvenile departments would be among those consulted by the Attorney General in the process of developing materials in Section 1. And so these materials do include that, and as we understand it, at any rate, that was the extent of the comments from the Juvenile Directors Association on the printed bill. The last thing I would point out as to the Dash 1 changes to Section 1 is in line 12, And you'll note the insertion of the word non-binding in line 12 as a modifier to the recommendations. And that, again, is to make clear that the Attorney General's role here is not to purport to govern the operations of other executive branch agencies, but rather to help inform their deliberations and to help advise them as to how improvements could be made. That was a change that, among others, the Oregon District Attorneys Association asked us to be sure was included in Section 1. So moving then to various provisions that will be effective if both the House joint resolutions are approved. The first is on page 2 of the admittedly messy hand and gross draft that you have. What I would propose to do is just very briefly touch on several elements that I would judge to be non-substantive amendments. Those are the changes in line 3. And also the incorporation or the importation of the constitutional definitions of victim and violent felony into the text of the Constitution. These changes are, the latter changes particularly, simply bring into the text of the bill the existing text of the constitutional definitions. On this page, there is one, I think, illustrative choice that the working group recommends to you in the Dash 1 amendments, and it's on line 23. And it is the striking the deletion of the words or well-being. You recall that this is part of the definition of what are termed critical stage of the proceeding. And among other things, a critical stage of the proceeding is a definition used to trigger the district attorney's certification to the trial court, or alternatively, the trial court's inquiry of the district attorney as to the compliance with the rights of the victim to that stage of whatever the particular case is. So it's a significant definition, and this deletion on line 23 of the phrase or well-being illustrates a general principle that the working group applied both in preparation of the printed bill and in the Dash 1 amendments, and that is that the general preference was to design legislation that was narrowly tailored to effectuate the victim's constitutional rights, but not to draw into this enforcement mechanism other interests of the victim or even other statutory rights that victims might have, and to draw those things and thus expand the intended scope of the bill. So when we looked in the working group at the phrase implicates a victim's rights or well-being, we realized that the victim's rights are those defined in the constitutional provision, but well-being, although the constitutional rights obviously are intended to benefit the victim, that abstract phrase didn't necessarily limit itself to the rights established in the Constitution. And so the deletion of the words or well-being isn't intended to be inimical to the interests of victims. Rather, it reflects the general principle that working group applied to tailor this remedy to the constitutional rights and to go no further than was necessary in order to accomplish that. On page 3 of the draft, the primary of the hand and gross version. The primary substantive change appears on line 5, and it consists of the addition of the words and 43 to line 5. And this is the flip side of the general principle that I just described to you. In the printed bill, what we required the prosecuting attorney to certify to was the compliance with Article 1, Section 42 rights. But as the working group reviewed the draft and decided in the Dash 1 amendments to make this change, the reason we did that was that we realized that was under-inclusive of the general principle of trying to effectuate all of the victim's constitutional rights. And so by adding the words and 43, we ensure that the district attorney certification includes a certification that says not only have we attempted to attempted to, we've not only have we informed the victim of the Section 42 rights under the Constitution, but also of the victim's rights under Section 43. The changes, the remainder of the changes on page 3 are really illustrative of the great amount of work that the working group has done both in the printed bill and in the Dash 1 amendments to try and reduce, wherever it is possible to do so, the call on judicial resources or the unnecessary call on judicial resources in processing the claim system that we have created. And here, for example, the handwritten material that follows line 4, that's inserted between line 14 and line 16 in your Hamden Gross draft, simply is intended to make it crystal clear that if the district attorney has provided the certification to the court, then the court doesn't need to go through the inquiry process that's described in subsection 3. So as to make it very clear that there's no further call upon the court's, trial court's resources as to the inquiries and interaction described in subsection 3. On page 4 of the draft, the primary substantive change is contained in between line 12 and line 13. And in particular, this was one that I foreshadowed to you when I described to you the printed bill a few days ago. And the particular subsection that's a substantive change is capital B, the interests of justice require the acceptance of the plea. You may recall that when we talked about this earlier this week, the context of this section is what does the court do in the event it ascertains that there hasn't been consultation between the prosecutor and the victim of a violent felony. And the Constitution requires such consultation as a general proposition. And what the bill formerly, the printed bill provides is that the court simply, there are no circumstances under which the court could go forward and accept the plea from the criminal defendant once the court determined that there hadn't been consultation. And in the work group, Judge Block from Multnomah County suggested there might be circumstances, extraordinary though they might be, in which it would be in the interest of justice for the court nonetheless to proceed. And so the working group agreed that it was prudent to give a court discretion to accommodate that extraordinary circumstance, and we tried to capture that idea in what you see there as capital B. The we've made numerous changes throughout the draft, throughout the bill, and then again in the Dash 1 amendments, to ensure that this system works in both the juvenile and adult court to the extent that there are overlaps to those two systems, and there are significant overlaps throughout the bill. And the changes that are described, that are set out in between line 17 and line 18 on page 4, really are simply examples of what I would characterize as non-substantive changes that the working group believes will better meld this bill with its application into what for many purposes are very different forums, the juvenile court forum and the adult forum. On page 5, there are significant substantive changes. These are changes that, again, I foreshadowed for the committee earlier this week. To orient you, Section 6 is the part of the bill that includes, it describes how the victim begins the process of invoking judicial machinery to assist in enforcement of their rights. The victim does that by filing by one of two ways, filing a written claim with the court on a form provided by the Supreme Court, or orally if all the players in that matter are present in the courtroom. And as you remember from the discussion earlier this week, we hadn't provided for the circumstance in which a claim filed by a victim was just facially invalid, didn't entitle, even if everything in it were true, didn't entitle the victim to any form of relief, and we hadn't provided any way for the court to get that out of the system based on a judgment about the inadequacy of that initial claim. And so we recognize that would call upon the court unnecessarily under the printed bill to convene a show cause hearing and to go through all the machinery of the process in a case in which it may simply be impossible for the court to grant the relief that's been requested by the victim in any form. So the working group recommends in the Dash 1 amendments that we add into the bill the words facially valid on lines 32 and 35 as indicated, and then that we add the new subsection 5 following line 41. And what this machinery amounts to is that the court now will look at the victim's claim, have the capacity to make a judgment based on it, that even if everything is true in the victim's claim, still there's no facially valid claim here presented for the court to decide. And if that's the conclusion of the court, then to enter an order that complies with the new subsection 5. And that order itself is appealable, so if the victim were to determine, were to object to the conclusion that the court reached as to the victim's claim, then the victim would still have a remedy as provided otherwise in the bill. On page 6, at lines 6 and 7, this is where I regret to inform the committee I made an error in hand engrossing the bill. I told the committee that we would probably have, the working group probably would have amendments that affected these lines. And these, again by way of orientation, this is the provision of the bill, one of the provisions, that provides that if a person doesn't receive notice of the claim and have an opportunity to contest that claim, then they can't be bound by the order that results from that process. It's a basic principle of federal due process law. What we hadn't provided previously, and we do provide now in the Dash 1 amendments, is that actual notice of the claim will suffice for purposes of satisfying due process. In other words, even though the person didn't receive notice of the formal order to show cause, if nonetheless they learn of it in a timely way that still permits them to appear in court and contest it, then they have not been denied due process even though they didn't actually receive notice. So the change here in the Dash 1 amendments that I didn't note in the hand-engrossed version would be on line 6 to strike the words have notice and insert receive notice or have knowledge of the claim. And those words are in the Dash 1 amendments, but so it would say on line 6, instead of have notice, receive notice or have knowledge of the claim. The other change that's worked on page 6 in the Dash 1 amendments is a change that I also foreshadowed for the committee that is necessary to accommodate a provision of Article 1, Section 42 of the Constitution that gives prosecuting attorneys the option in cases involving organized crime or cases in which the victim is a child to interpose an affidavit that explains to the court why in that case the victim in that particular case ought not be permitted to invoke the machinery of the bill. And so the provision, the handwritten new subsection B that follows line 22 on page 6, and then also on page 7 in the handwritten insertion at line 32, the portion of that insertion that reads, or that the prosecuting attorney has set forth cause to suspend the victim's rights under section 7.4b, the new section on page 6, then the court shall issue an order denying relief. And again, that's to give effect to the provision in the Constitution that permits prosecuting attorneys to interpose such an affidavit in those kind of cases. On page 7, we have suggested in the Dash 1 amendments that the time allowed should be, or the time before trial should be extended from 14 to 21 days in order to smoke out pretrial motions that would affect, involving victims' rights, that might affect the operation of the trial. And you remember when we talked about this earlier, what we were trying to address in Section 9 of the printed bill is the problem of trying to raise and get resolved as quickly as possible claims involving victims' rights that otherwise have the potential to cause day of trial delay in the proceedings. And so the working group suggests to you in the Dash 1 amendments that we make that period before the trial longer, lengthen it to 21 days, but then also add a provision that says, as you can see on line 43, the court shall promptly conduct a hearing under Section 11 of this 2008 Act and rule on the motion as soon as practicable, so that, again, to signal to the trial court that it's everyone's hope that we can resolve these long before the day of trial. And part of the reason for that is, I know you know from other your experience in the area, that really one of the most costly kinds of delays that we have in the criminal justice system are day of trial delays, because you have the police officer there, perhaps on overtime, summoned to come into court. You have witnesses, of course, and jurors and court staff that wouldn't otherwise be engaged or be obligated. And so the idea, again, of Section 9 and of the Dash 1 amendments to that is try and drive that process forward so that we get those resolved before the day of trial arrives. On the next page, on page 8, the substantive amendment isn't so much substantive as it is reinforcing of one of the principles underlying the way we've structured the relationship between claims by victims both in the trial court and on appeal and other matters that are pending in the same criminal proceeding. And that principle is we emphasized with the suggested new language at line 1, all other matters in the criminal proceeding shall continue in the ordinary course. This, again, is in relation to the trial court's ability to reschedule other matters, reschedule matters that are related to the victim's claim, but we wanted to make it absolutely clear that the court can and should go ahead with processing things that are unrelated to the victim's claim so that the machinery of the processing of that case proceeds unabated. The next substantive amendment takes place quite a few pages later. And it's substantive in this sense. Each of the substantive amendments that I've talked about as to the section we've addressed so far, each of those is reflected effectively in triplicate because, as you recall, we have to take account of the contingency that H.R. 49 is approved and 50 is rejected, or 50 is approved and 49 is rejected. And so I'll take you to page 13 of the bill, and these are, I will simply say, as to all of the changes in sections 20 to 37 are designed to maintain parallel construction with the changes we've just discussed in 219. And so they're substantive in that sense, is that those same substantive changes are carried forward in all of the parallel provisions, but they are really simply moving in lockstep with the changes that we've discussed. I don't propose to take the committee through those, from which I suspect
I'd be appreciative. Yeah. I make political judgments all the time, Mr. Shepherd, and I think we're willing to make the political judgment that we don't need to be walked through that contingency.
Very good. Well, that Mr. Chair, that happily enables us to move to page 32. Page 32 is the beginning, section 56 at the bottom of that page, is the beginning of the part of the bill, as you can see, that's entitled Statutory Amendments and Repeals. And I'm not going to walk you through all of those, but I do want to describe to you, there are some new provisions in this, and I want to flag those for you, but I want to explain them in context of the amendments. But I promise I won't walk you through each of them line by line, Mr. Taylor. There are three kinds of changes made in the sections that involve statutory amendments and repeals. The first categorical change, and it really only affects one statute, is repeal of existing law. And that statute that is repealed is ORS 135-406. And again, as you may remember from our discussion earlier this week, that's repealed not because anything will change about the obligations, but because those are the text of that provision is carried forward into this bill. So that's the reason 135-406 is changed. That's category number one. And in the dash one amendments, there are no new repeals that you need to be concerned about. Category number two are changes to statutes that are necessitated because of category number one. So we have some statutes that cross-reference by statutory citation 135-406, but obviously because that's being repealed by the bill, now we have to modify those statutes to strike that, to make that cross-reference accurate, or to strike it as the case may be. And so, for example, if you look at page 33, line 5, you can see an example of that, what I call category number two amendments. It is an amendment to ORS 131-007, and you've got the long list of statutes that are cross-referenced in that law. Well, we're repealing 135-406, so it needs to come out of that reference. So that change, that's category number two. And again, I don't think there are any new amendments in the dash ones that are in category number two, because we don't have any new repeals of statutes. It's in category number three where there is some new material in the dash one amendments. And let me illustrate category number three with one that we talked about earlier this week. And that's, I draw your attention to page 34. And on page 34, section 60 at line 21 amends ORS 419C-273, a part of the juvenile code. And as you remember from our discussion, this is one of the statutes that currently includes provisions that may be, if the people amend the Constitution, contradicted by elements of the Constitution. And so it's necessary to go into those statutes and to strike the provisions from those statutes that may be, if the people amend the Constitution, no longer consistent with the requirements of the Constitution. And these changes to 419C-273 are in the printed bill. And, of course, these kinds of changes, again, are all done in triplicate, again, and so you'll see as you work your way through the various sections, those same changes carried forward. Now, as to this third category of statutory changes, there are new statutes that are contained in the dash one amendments that have similar or changes motivated by those same category three rationale. And legislative council helped us identify what these statutes were, and they weren't in the printed bill, but they are in the dash one amendments. I'll simply tell you what they are, again, not go through them in detail. Section 63 amends ORS 137-545. Section 64 amends 147-417. Section 65 amends 144-108. Section 66 amends 144-343. And Section 67 amends 419A-004. And so those changes and their triplicate counterparts carry us all the way through to page 86 of the draft. On pages 86 and through to the remainder of the draft, these are the provisions of the bill that describe the effective and operative dates of the bill. And these changes are modified in the Dash 1 amendments as compared to the printed bill, but primarily to take account of the fact that we've tinkered with different statutes. And so, again, I wouldn't characterize any of the changes here as being significant in the context of the printed bill. And I think that takes us through the end of the Dash 1, the primary policy issues in the Dash 1 amendments.
Are there any questions for Mr. Shepherd about this overview of the Dash 1 amendments? Council
Chair, Mr. Committee, I have two questions for you. First off, it's my assumption that House Bill 3633 is not intended to give rights that are not tied to the Constitution, so it's not giving any rights greater than otherwise would be in the Constitution as it would be, assuming it's amended. Is that correct?
The Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, the enforcement mechanism in the bill is tailored to the constitutional rights. That's what a victim is entitled to claim under Section 6.1 of the bill in the Hand and Gross version on page 5, lines 23 and 24. A victim who wishes to allege a violation of a right granted by Section 42 or 43, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, to a victim in a criminal proceeding can do these things and invoke the machinery. Section 1 of the bill is not, for example, limited solely to the victim's constitutional rights. The Attorney General's function in trying to improve the overall system might well address things that weren't limited to constitutional rights, per se. So I think as to the bulk of the bill, the answer to your question is yes. And certainly as to the enforcement mechanism, the answer is yes.
All questions and comments of the committee. Mr. Shepherd, could you give us an example of Section 1, how it could go beyond the rights of the granted by the Constitution?
Chairman Ferson, Mr. Taylor, an example of a victim's right which is not constitution-based, but instead statutory-based, is the right to have I believe the statute calls it a personal representative in the criminal justice process to accompany the victim through. That was a right created, I believe, by the 2005 regular session. So that's at least one example of a non-constitutional right. And that is why in Section 1, Line 10, in line 11, it refers to lines 10 and 11, rights granted to victims of crime in the criminal and juvenile justice systems by law. So it's intended very deliberately to embrace both constitutional and statutory rights.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, what I need a better understanding about is how the Dash 1 amendments, which we have before us, relate to the Dash 2 amendments, which were referred to earlier and which apparently are being prepared. What subject matter is being addressed in the Dash 2s? And I do understand that both are on a consensus basis, as we understand it at this time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have prepared a hand-engrossed version of the Dash 2 amendments. If the committee would like to look at them, I've got sufficient copies for you. I thought the question might come up. But I want to give you a caution that, unlike the Dash 1 amendments, which were prepared by legislative counsel, the Dash 2 amendments arise from my best effort to capture the discussion of the working group yesterday. So what you'll see in the Dash 2 amendments, and I displayed them in context of the Hand and Gross version of the Dash 1 amendments so you can see how they work with the Dash 1 amendments. I'd be happy to, if you'd like, walk you through those. They're much shorter than the
ones. That was going to be my next question, was how much of a project would it be for just to take a look at those? I mean, we're on a fast track here, and I think we ought to try to cover as much ground as we can.
I'll hand them to your staff.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, while we're doing that, one time I tried a case in a courtroom in which the air conditioning had failed, and the judge gave us authority to take our coats off, and like a young, foolish attorney, I didn't want to be the first one to take my coat off, so to the amazement of the jury, I sat there through the whole trial with my coat on, but I'm pretty hot. Can I take my coat off?
Mr. Shepherd, absolutely.
Thanks.
I think it's the temperature coming over from the Revenue Committee.
No, it's the Lending Practices Committee next door. It's coming from there.
So which one?
It's been one of those days. I apologize.
And if you could maybe start out by explaining why it is we have dash ones and dash twos. Are there thematic differences between the two sets that I understand?
Mr. Chair, there are not thematic differences between the two sets. The fact that you have dash ones and dash twos is simply an effect of our accelerated time schedule. We have had, as I think I mentioned last time, very able assistance of Mr. Nasby, and the working group has been working hammer and tongs on this material. And as we completed the first run through of the material, we did not yet have in hand the full comments from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association or the American Civil Liberties Union as to the set of amendments that we had completed by the time we had a window of opportunity to call Mr. Nasby's time. So we gave him what we had as the dash one amendments, and now these represent the completed set of amendments that we expect from the work group by yesterday's meeting. We understand that everybody has offered all the comments that they would like.
Would it be fair then to generalize that the dash two amendments then are ones that are in response to concerns expressed by the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and the ACLU?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the most part that's true. We also had some, our work group includes many imaginative members, and their imagination continued to work as to elements of the draft, and so there are a few spontaneous amendments that surfaced. But for the most part, the dash two amendments were sparked by the receipt of additional comments from the OCDLA and the ACLU.
Okay.
May I add, Mr. Chair, that to the extent the comments were addressing the appellate provisions of the measure, the OCDLA had suggested that those particular sections be reviewed and issues relating to them be discussed by a representative of the OCDLA and by Jim Nass of the Judicial Department and Mary Williams, the Solicitor General. So the appellate provisions, modifications of the appellate sections in these dash two amendments are the outgrowth of initially of that three-way discussion and then the work group's receipt of their recommendations yesterday.
Okay.
I think that discussion also included the Public Defense Services, Office of Public Defense Services as well, the folks who provide indigent appellate representation.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'll walk you through the hand engrossed with 3633-1 and anticipated 3633-2 consensus amendment document that you now have in front of you. On the first page, there are no amendments as to the dash two. And in the handout that you have, I didn't duplicate pages of the hand engrossed dash one amendments that weren't affected by the dash two amendments. And so we jump, as you can see, to what's labeled as page six, but it's actually the second physical page of the handout you have.
Okay.
And you can distinguish between the dash two changes and the dash one changes that we've already discussed by looking over in the left-hand column, and if there's excuse me, a little star in the left-hand column, that's a dash two amendment, and otherwise it is carryover from the dash ones. So on this page, for example, the proposed amendment in the dash two amendments would be to substitute responses for objections, which I would judge to be a change without substance, but it's done to maintain consistency with the structure of the bill, in which the way generally that you contest a victim's claim is by filing a response, not by filing an objection. So on page 7 of the bill, this I think is the only part of the dash 2 amendments that actually amends the dash 1s. And that occurs, as you can see, on line 20, between lines 29 and 30. And in the dash 1 amendments, we're adding the language, shall issue an appropriate remedial order after giving due consideration to the proposed remedy. And in the dash 2 amendments, the working group recommends that you strike the word remedial. In the discussions yesterday with the working group, we did reach consensus that the word remedial really didn't add anything to the provisions, to the kind of order that the court is issuing under this section. The court still has the duty to issue an appropriate order under the circumstances. And it was pointed out that if we leave the word remedial in, if the court were to conclude that there wasn't any relief that the court could grant, if we left the word remedial in, the court might feel obliged to search around vainly for some kind of remedy for the circumstances that still would be barred by law. So it was judged to be more prudent to take that out. So that aspect of the dash 2 amendments would further amend the bill if you have already adopted the dash 1 amendments. On page 8, which is the fourth physical page, or the fourth sheet, at any rate, of the material that you have, on lines 39 and 40, the dash 2 amendments would make an adjustment by enlarging the number of people or the classifications of individuals who would receive from the court a copy of the order that the court issued. Printed bill, a person against whom relief was requested who participated in the hearing would receive a copy of the court's order, but a person who filed a response but didn't participate in the hearing wouldn't necessarily receive a copy of the court's order. And so the working group proposes in the dash, what you will see eventually as the dash 2 amendments, to enlarge the classification of individuals who will receive a copy of the court's order to include any person who filed a response and any person against whom relief was ordered, regardless of whether the individual participated in the hearing or not. And let me say that this change takes account, as best we can, of, again, one of the sort of drafting principles that we followed. In early iterations of the draft of this bill, feedback from the Judicial Department indicated that one of the problems for them from a workability standpoint would be if we were requiring the court to give notice to persons whose addresses the court wouldn't have at that stage of the proceeding. If, in other words, we are putting in some way an obligation on the court to go out and ferret out an address so as to accomplish sending the notice or sending a copy of the order to somebody who wasn't there in court, and thus the court would have to do some research outside the record, if you will. And so these provisions of the bill, and in particular lines 38 to 40, are intended to place on the court only those burdens that the court is likely to be able to fulfill from the record of the court, the paper record of the court that's before it, or from people who are physically there in the courtroom so as to inform the court as to their address for purposes of receiving the notice.
It's kind of a technical point, but Mr. Shepard, I'm just trying to visualize who besides victim, prosecuting attorney, defendant would be a person against whom relief would have been ordered. Sort of visualize,
Mr. Chair, one example of that we discussed to some extent in my earlier appearance, and that would be an investigator employed by the defense. And as we talked about last time I appeared here. Conceivably, a victim would find it desirable to seek relief in the form of an order that orders the defense investigator to refrain from continuing to contact the victim in a way that the victim alleges violates the victim's constitutional right to be free from inquiries from the defense counsel or from the defendant. And so it's conceivable that a victim would seek from the court an order directly compelling or forbidding a defense investigator from making further contact.
Okay, thank you.
On page 9 of the bill, or the materials rather, the hand and gross version, on line 31, the dash 2 amendments, and on line 33, the dash 2 amendments have been reworked to try to more clearly and sharply delineate the division point between cases in which appeal is mandatory, jurisdiction is mandatory in the Oregon Supreme Court, and in those cases, that other class of cases in which jurisdiction is discretionary with the court. These changes are not intended to change the policy choice that I discussed with the committee earlier as to how to draw that distinction, but rather to more clearly delineate those lines so that there can be no, or at least hopefully much less confusion than might otherwise exist as to whether a given case falls in that category or not. And so rather than using the term disposition in line 31, we have substituted, and we recommend substituting in the dash 2 amendments, a phrase, something to the effect of pronouncement in open court of sentence or disposition after plea, admission, or trial in the criminal proceeding. And the reason for that is that that will make it very clear, we hope, that upon the initial plea, admission, or disposition in a juvenile proceeding, that when the court announces or pronounces its sentence or disposition of the juvenile proceeding, that proceeding is everything up to that point is subject to the mandatory jurisdiction in terms of appeal, mandatory jurisdiction of the Supreme Court in terms of appeal. But everything after that point, and specifically we're thinking here trying to capture probation revocation proceedings, which would arise after the point that the court pronounced sentence in the way I've described, in some subsequent proceeding, those proceedings, even though they take place in the same felony or person class A misdemeanor case, those in the design of the bill are put in the second category of appellate matters, the discretionary appeal. And so this language that's to be inserted in substitute for disposition of is intended to make that as clear as we can in the context of the way these cases actually develop. And then likewise the change to line 33 is intended to very clearly delineate that everything else is a discretionary appeal matter. On page 10 of the bill, at line 32, as I indicated, the Office of Public Defense Services participated in the most recent iteration of discussions of the draft, suggestion was that that office should receive should be among those who receive the materials on appeal so that they have notice of the appeal and of the claims that are being made on appeal if that office is representing the defendant in the case. At the bottom of that page, I've noted the addition of new subsections B and C to subsection 6. And this is, as I note, conceptual language developed by the work group. The work group itself arrived at this as sort of a description of principles but recognize that this language needs to be retooled by legislative counsel. But the purpose of these new provisions is to take account, as we work through very carefully, these are extraordinarily tight deadlines on appeal. And we have provided, in some instances, that service, the deadline for service of notice of the appeal, that's the service of the materials that inform the other parties to the matter what relief is being sought on appeal, that notice is due by the person seeking the appeal on the same day as the date that they actually physically file those materials with the Supreme Court. Now, that's not the usual rule when it comes to the deadlines for serving the other people who are interested or potentially interested in an appeal. But because of the very tight deadlines, the work group recommends to you that in the Dash 2 amendments, you make clear that service on defendant's counsel, if the defendant is represented by counsel, the Office of Public Defense Services, prosecuting attorney, and the Attorney General occur on the same day that the appellant deliver the materials to the court, so that those folks, all of whom have, of course, regular business offices and thus can be located easily by the appellant, can get to work under the very tight timelines that we have provided for appeal. As to a different category, however, unrepresented defendants and any respondent who's not described in the list that I just gave you, unrepresented defendants may not have an easily accessible regular business office to which the appellant could go on the day they deliver their materials to the Supreme Court and satisfy the very tight timelines. And so what the working group recommends in the Dash 2 amendments is that we allow appellants a little bit more time, although not much more, to accomplish service of the notice on that class of individuals. And so that's the effect of capital B at the bottom of the page. As I say, I do anticipate that in all these Dash 2 amendments, but in particular as to that section, one can anticipate that legislative counsel will improve our language there. On page 11 of the materials, in the Dash 2 amendment, on line 32, this really just reinforces the principle we talked about before, that we want everything to proceed in the matter except to the extent that it's necessary to accommodate either the extraordinarily tight timelines or to make possible the effectuation of the victim's rights. So here we provided on line 32 that if the Supreme Court is considering summary affirmance, that is, a quick way of disposing of the matter that arises before it, that the fact that somebody has asked the court to do that very quickly doesn't relieve anybody from complying with the rest of the timelines, because the court might not grant the summary affirmance, and then we would be running up against all the other timelines in the bill. And so this simply provides that this puts everybody on notice. You better keep working on your stuff within the very short timeline that you have, because these timelines are not told while the court is considering your request that it get rid of this case very quickly. On page 12, what looks like a substantive amendment really is not. The effect of the two amendments on lines 10, 11, and line 2 proposed by the Dash 2 amendments is not to mean that the Supreme Court can affirm an unconstitutional trial court order, even though we're proposing in the Dash 2 amendments to strike subparagraph B on line 10, or that the Supreme Court could affirm an order that doesn't have support in the record. It's merely that we, as to line 10, the order is unconstitutional. We've also provided that the court Supreme Court can reverse or remand an order if it finds it's unlawful. Well, if an order is unconstitutional, it's clearly unlawful. So there's no need to have line 10 in order to preserve that for Supreme Court review. And as to line 11, we have provided in line 2 in the proposed insertion after the word fact, that the standard of review for the court is that the Supreme Court shall review challenges to factual findings for evidence in the record to support the finding. And so that would supersede the subsection C standard. Again, still would require the court to look at the record and ask itself whether there was evidence in the record to support factual issues. Mr. Chair, we're very close to the end of the dash 2 amendments. And I would, actually the last one is on line 25 on page 86. And here we're dealing with a part of the bill that governs to what proceedings the machinery of the bill will apply. And in the printed bill, and that this was an aspect of the printed bill unaffected by the Dash 1 amendments, we provided that that the enforcement mechanism of the bill would apply to criminal proceedings pending in any court on or commenced on or after the operative date specified in paragraph A of the subsection. That operative date is the 30 days after the people approve the, if they do approve, HGR 4950. And so that gave rise to the question in the working group yesterday. Let's suppose that a violation of a victim's rights occurred prior to that operative date in a case that nonetheless is still pending on the date that this law goes into effect. First question, under the printed bill, could that victim then bring forward a claim under the machinery of the bill? And the answer is that yes, the victim could bring such a claim forward. That led to the next question was, well, what would the printed bill teach us about whether that claim would survive, how far back those claims could go? In other words, if a victim had learned, say, a year before the bill went into effect, that the victim's rights had been violated, but at that time had no enforcement mechanism to turn to for relief, now the bill goes into effect, what is the effect, if any, is that victim's claim revived by the passage of the bill and the provisions of what appears lines 23 to 25 on page 86 of the materials that you're looking at? That was at least an ambiguity under the bill. And so what we propose in the Dash 2 amendments is to add something like this, or this principle anyway, to this section. And it would say, provided that no claim barred by section 6.1 shall be allowed. And section 6.1 says that a victim has to bring a claim within 7 days of the date that they learned of or should have learned of, or in the language of the bill, had knowledge of or should have had knowledge of the fact that their rights had been violated. So what that would tell us is that if a victim had learned a year before the bill goes into effect that their rights had been violated, that case is still pending on the effective date, and you amend it as provided in the Dash 2 amendments, that victim's claim would be cut off. So another way to think of it is that the effect of the Dash 2 amendment on line 25 would be to provide as to violations that occurred prior to the operative date as to which the victim knew will only go back 7 days before the operative date of the language, and those will be the only claims that victims could bring forward. As to claims that the victim couldn't reasonably have known of in a pending case that's pending on the operative date of the bill, those would be viable claims going forward. And so, again, because of the triplicate structure of the bill, those same changes are made on the remainder of the pages, and that brings us to the end of the Dash 2 amendments.
Okay. Ms. Shepherd, any questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I just want to commend you for you, Mr. Shepherd, and Attorney General Myers for how thorough your work was on this and how clear your explanation is. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bonamici, I hate to follow up on that by saying I left something out, but but I did. Hardy, do you want to address that last section? We have one last section that appears as page 89 of your materials. And
back of the last page of the handout.
In the work group, there had been discussion about whether or not how can the legislature best be informed as to the operation of this new regime of enforcement, its efficiency, its cost, etc. And that discussion led to a suggestion by me that we invite the legislature to create an attorney general-led task force that would be charged to assess the operation of the measure and to report regularly on it prior to July 1st of each even-numbered year to the Assembly. This is the provision of the Dash 2 amendments, which was really the largest action of an act of just new drafting. So it really hasn't been examined or commented on by the work group yet. I think that it might be good if I have that chance between now and the very near term. But as indicated here, the starting proposal would be that the task force would, at a minimum, consist of certain members whose perspectives would be important to assessing how well this new regime of enforcement is actually operating. So that's the genesis of that further proposal, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Is it contemplated that this task force would continue on perpetually, or is there some thought that there's some period of sort of transition in as people get accustomed to the new regime, that after which it wouldn't need to operate anymore? But what you're thinking about the lifespan of this effort?
Chair McPherson, I think as it's presently drafted, it doesn't have any termination provisions in it, and that may be a further change that will be wanting to explore if the very concept itself is agreeable ultimately to the committee. As I say, this was created as a start on the general concept that the work group endorsed yesterday at its meeting, without having before at that time any specific language to mm-hmm. to implement such a notion, such a proposal.
When a task force of this sort is convened and continued, and it meets periodically, what kinds of costs to the Department of Justice or to the state are incurred? Is there other expenses for participation that then end up being borne by the state?
Chair McPherson, another very good question, which we haven't really had a chance to think through yet, and I don't know to what extent there would be other existing statutory provisions which would entitle the members of a work group of this kind to payment of travel, for example, travel expenses, or whether that would need to be specified specifically if that were the wish of the Assembly. So another as yet not fully thought through kind of detail.
Okay. Any questions from the committee about this additional item or anything else that was in the presentation?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the Attorney General's suggestion. I can see maybe, you know, reporting on what we've done with the legislation and all that, and I'm not sure about continuation, but I would definitely, you know, want to see what your task force or work group on the bill brings forth, Mr. Attorney General.
Chair McPherson and Vice Chair Wisman, I think the concept was at a minimum that there will be recommended to you an orderly way in which there could be created for the legislature an assessment of at least the first 2 years of the operation of this new regime, as I'm calling it, for purposes of and recommendations, if any, for change to it for the Assembly's consideration as well. So I'm not sure that it would be inconsistent with the spirit of the discussions of the work group, if this conception were otherwise agreeable to the Assembly, that a 2-year lifespan were put on it for purposes of getting to the 2011 session, I guess.
That's maybe an element of a sort of a broader inquiry here about the fiscal impacts. And now this bill is going to go on to the Ways and Means Committee from this committee, and so There will be a separate kind of inquiry into fiscal impacts, but one of the things about this bill is that it does. There's quite a bit of structure being created, and we have to always have to be careful about what when we tell our courts and our prosecutors to do things that we are triggering, maybe sometimes without full appreciation, the costs that could flow from that. I see Ms. Cosine sitting in the back of the room, and I think we understood there was going to be some fiscal information available here soon, but I'm forgetting it. When we, either from our witnesses here or the dais or Ms. Cosine, when do we expect to see any kind of fiscal information? Would it, before the bill leaves this committee?
We will have fiscal information prepared. We're working on it right now, trying to make it as clear and understandable as possible, and we hope to have it in by the end of the day.
By end of day, okay. What I would urge about this provision here, I'm also always sensitive to creating more structure than need be to solve a particular problem, and so I would urge that there be a sunset on this, or there'd be a transition period for implementation rather than a contemplated sort of open-ended thing, regardless of whether there's much out-of-pocket cost, because it may be that with volunteer effort and no expenses being reimbursed, that maybe the cost is minimal of having the task force. But I do observe that in my years in public service that we tend to create structure in response to need, and that structure doesn't necessarily go away after the people's excitement about the need has dissipated. So it might, you might stir that into your thinking about what comes is brought back here in the Dash 2 amendments.
Well, and Chair McPherson, of course, if a termination date of this assignment, if you will, of the task force were added, it would always lie to the session closest to that termination to extend the life of the task force.
Yes.
If it felt that it was useful to have yet another round of review and reporting, and assessment and reporting to the Assembly.
So what we understand about the Dash 2 amendments, which we realize have to go through the Legislative Council, is that those address the concerns that were being expressed by OCDLA and the ACLU. Now, I do see that Ann Christian has come into the room. And Ms. Christian, did you want us to comment at all today, or are you going to come back and talk to us on Monday about the bill? Okay. Okay, that's fine. We do have the it was indicated to us that with these changes, obviously yet we go through Legislative Council, that we are addressing the concerns that your organization had, and so if there is if that is a misunderstanding about where things are headed, it would be helpful to know that.
Mr. Chair, why don't I just come up for the
please,
record.
My
name is Ann Christian, and I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I would first commend the Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General for the work group tireless effort in this regard. To answer, Chair, your question, OCDLA has been a part of this work group, and we are at the point with the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments and with the press of time that we have a neutral position on the bill as amended by both sets of amendments, with the commitment that we continue the work for on some issues that we have and couldn't reach consensus on for the 2009 session.
Okay. Well, it would be the Chair's hope that we would, if we can get the Dash 2 amendments through the Legislative Council process, that we'd be in a position to move the bill on Monday. Well, obviously, there's a lot of time pressure on everybody, all the resources that are in the building here during this supplemental session, but if we were in a position to do that, we would like to move it forward.
And we understand that, Mr. Chair, and we're fine with that.
Okay, very good. Okay. Well, are there any remaining questions from the committee to anybody who are here who has presented? If not, then thank you very much, gentlemen. We really do appreciate the hard work you've put in, and we think we're getting an excellent product here. Let's move forward. That concludes the work session. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3633, and that concludes our agenda.
That's my question for the good of the order.
Yeah.
Any follow-up after our vote on the AIP, or when we're going to see something on that, or what's...
Actually, yeah, Council Taylor, if you
and the other follow-on to that is, when do you expect what's happening on the other side of the Senate as far as which bills are going to be coming here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there was no, we will be working on the language for the AIP provision this afternoon. As you know, it's tied up with a lot of other issues from the last time I heard, which was a little while ago, and this changes every half hour, is that they've come to a tentative agreement on the outline of the package, and it's now just simply putting the details together. Hopefully that will be done by today, and then it'll be the Legislative Council's office for drafting.
Yeah. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Taylor, I understand now that I understood that the work group is looking at maybe putting AIP in the bill that they're going to put forth along with Measure 40. Is that true, or is it going to, we're still going to have a separate AIP?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Wisnet, I think that's probable, but I'm not 100% sure.
And that bill will come from the Senate if it has the AIP. We don't need to do our bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnet, you very well could see two bills that are very similar to each other. One being a referral, the other one being a statute. But I want to caveat this because it changes, and I've been in the office taking care of things like this, and I have not been involved in all the conversations, so I sometimes get it second and third hand information.
Vice Chair.
I don't have the latest information on that.
Thank you.
If I could, Mr. Chair, just some of the conversation I've heard is that these bills will have, they come over from the Senate, will have a fiscal attached to them, so they would probably go to Ways and Means, I presume.
Not come here at all.
And then on the AIP, a rules call for it to go to Rules, but with the rules suspension, it is theoretically possible for this committee to deal with.
Any further questions or discussion? Then that concludes our agenda. I'll close the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Friday, February 8, 2008.